All right. You know, I've had four people now say, how do you follow that? And the Kathy Kinnett very wisely reached over to me and said, you follow that by saying you will do everything you possibly can to change the outcome for the cardiovascular disease for this group of kids. And I think that I feel incredibly blessed this morning to have a panel of people who have flown here, some at incredible trauma to their personal selves with regards to being in airports and stranded and in storms, and to say that we really are committed to changing the cardiovascular disease in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And I also want to acknowledge all the pediatric cardiologists who are in the audience who have come here to partner as well to make a difference. Are we ready yet? No. I guess I got to keep talking because the slides aren't ready. But so let me introduce how we're going to be doing this morning. So we have three cardiologists and a cardiac surgeon, and I'll introduce them individually when it's their time to speak. And we're going to be sort of stepping through the disease as it occurs. The first speaker we're going to have, we're fortunate to have from Baltimore. He is a pediatric cardiologist at Johns Hopkins University, Reed Thompson. He is the cardiologist who's involved in the neuromuscular center at Kennedy Krieger Institute, as well as the neuromuscular center at Johns Hopkins University. And I feel incredibly blessed to have known him since early training at Boston Children's. I think you'll find him do an outstanding job, and he's going to talk a little bit about heart failure and medications and treatments that are available for children with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. We're going to follow that with Naomi Cortez, who's one of my colleagues at Nationwide Children's Hospital, a pediatric electrophysiologist or an individual who specializes in pediatric rhythm disorders, who's going to talk to us about heart rhythm disorders in this disease, the use of implantable defibrillators, and the indications for those devices. Following that, we're going to have Dr. David Morales from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, a cardiac surgeon who's the co-director of the Heart Institute there, who is a specialist has an incredible interest in placing ventricular assist devices or artificial pumps that, when the heart fails to pump as well as it should in this disease, is a potential option for these boys. And we're going to finish with Charlie Cantor, a national and international specialist in pediatric heart transplantation, to talk to you about is transplantation an option in this patient population. So I think we're ready to go now. So I'll start and welcome Reed.
Let's see. What did you say? Okay, minimize the document. So I don't really know Max very well. Probably. Yeah. This is. Sorry. No. No, it's Thompson. Thank you, Linda and Kathy and Pat, for inviting me to speak today. And I just want to say to Chris and Natalie, thank you so much for sharing that extremely touching. I know that's very difficult, and we're all moved, and the medical community is moved, and we appreciate you just allowing us to look at this disease and look at your personal life. And I just saw on your webpage the quote, love is a verb, and I think you really expressed that to all of us. And some of my colleagues think that this is one of the more difficult problems to take on as a specialty, a clinical or research specialty, because of experiences like this. But it's also a great challenge, and I think we all find a motivation in figuring a better way, something that can change that outcome. So very inspirational. Thank you for that. And I wanted to just welcome to Baltimore on the last day of the conference. Sorry I wasn't able to make it for the earlier parts. It looks like it's been wonderful. This is a picture of the Kennedy Krieger Institute on the left, and then the new Johns Hopkins Children's Center. And we do have multidisciplinary clinics at both places. And I am happy to be the cardiologist for the pediatric side of things at both places. And then I have an adult colleague, Dan Judge, who takes care of the adult patients. And so we work together. I think in a short period of time, I just want to briefly go through my view of where we currently are with medical management. I'd like to think of it, the treatment of disease in terms of three stages. There's the stage one, which is the normal, quote, normal cardiac function, roughly under 12 years, but part of the challenge and the paradox or the difficulty of this gene is that, of this disease, is that we know the gene, it's a single gene disorder, we've known it for 30 years, but there are manifold expressions, and the cardiac expression doesn't necessarily fit with the skeletal muscle expression, and the predictions of when these stages are going to occur are not reliable. So generally, we can think of stage one being under 12 years, roughly, and then the stage where heart decline becomes evident on the usual tests we do between 14 and 18, maybe, and then severe dysfunction, usually in the 20s. And this is a list of some of the medications that we use. I will go into a little bit of detail on them. But just to start saying, what are we looking at with heart dysfunction? What does that actually mean? So I hopefully can get this to play. Anybody have a clue? Maybe if I click. There we go. It's easy. This is a normal heart. We're looking at it by an echocardiogram, an ultrasound, and it's showing good function in a five-year-old patient with muscular dystrophy. We measure the fractional shortening. We can also measure ejection fraction in three different ways. And that is just looking at how much the blood is pumping out, what the percentage of flow. And this is a normal range for this patient, 36%. We now have some ways of looking at the muscle itself by the same technology, by ultrasound. And we can look at not just the cavity size, how it changes. We can look at the muscle and say, does each individual segment of the muscle have the normal amount of function? And a number of minus 20 at this age group or even over minus 18 is normal, and this patient has normal function. And we can map those little segments and look at a bullseye of the entire ventricle, average that up and come out with a number, again, normal range, minus 23.7. Now let's compare it to someone that is entering into stage two. This is a 15-year-old with muscular dystrophy that, if we look at this heart, it is two things. It's a little harder to see, and this is typical, and this is where we start thinking about using alternative imaging, MRI. But by echo, we were able to, again, measure it, and we still get normal range for the fractional shortening here. But now we're starting to detect a difference at the tissue level. And these strain curves are now lower, and our average strain, instead of being in the 18 to 20 range, is 13.9. We do that bullseye mapping, and you can just see the numbers now, how they're different. There's a different look to the myocardium. Something has changed. Yet our normal numbers of ejection haven't changed. They're still in the range we would call normal. And the average of the strain is minus 13.7, but the ejection fraction 65. Something has happened. And when we did an MRI on this patient, we found some evidence of some fibrosis. And this corresponds to this difference we're seeing now in strain. Here's what the MRI looks like when there is scar tissue in the heart. So we want to analyze not only the ejection, but we want to analyze what's going on at the tissue level, because this is an early way of knowing that there is involvement of the heart. And then finally, in a patient that is 23, is in this sort of third stage, I think you can easily see oops, you can easily see if it'll play, but it doesn't play, that this heart is more dilated. It is not squeezing well at all. I apologize. And the strain map on this heart has changed a lot. And there's scar tissue at the level of the average. Instead of being 18 to 20, it's now 4.7. And the squeeze really very poor. So the ejection fraction's low. The strain is very abnormal. And this is a patient who would have been already on medications, and we would be adding some medications at that time. You did a fantastic job of presenting the fact that there are often no symptoms to go on. These are some of the differences of treating muscular dystrophy heart failure and treating other types of heart failure, because the patients typically are not exercising, they're not walking, they're not expressing that they're short of breath the way that we sort of gauge need for medications. We have to look at other things. This big variability of cardiac involvement is a challenge and makes this different from other types of heart failure we deal with. A response to steroids. There are very few other diseases I know of that treating for years with steroids changes the outcome of the cardiac function. This is unique to muscular dystrophy. Sensitivity to medications, especially the blood pressure. So when we start medicines on patients with muscular dystrophy, we have to be very aware of the fact that their fluid balance may be a bit tricky. Adding medications may be difficult. We may run into some problems with side effects. And then the role of the respiratory compromise, and that affects the heart, and the heart function affects the respiratory compromise, as well as considerations for advanced treatment in the setting of severe skeletal muscle weakness and diaphragm weakness. These are all unique aspects of muscular dystrophy. So just we'll start with why would we use heart medications? What are we trying to accomplish? And I think the bottom line, most important thing is to prolong life. Very severe cardiac dysfunction increases the risk of arrhythmias. Arrhythmias lead to sudden death. We want to try to avoid that. If we can avoid that severe decline, we will prolong life. We will stabilize decline in function if we can initiate medications in a stepwise method. And then a lesser goal is to treat symptoms, because symptoms aren't particularly common, but this might lead to additional therapies. So another question would be, how do we know the medication is actually working? So we should continue it or push on even if we think there may be some symptoms. How do we judge that? It's very difficult to say, because we're not looking for an improvement in symptoms typically. Often we don't even expect a major change in ejection fraction or shortening fraction. We don't know about changes in strain, changes in scar. We're anticipating maybe some improvements based on some laboratory experiments, but we don't know yet whether these will be good surrogates to follow that may lead to improvements in longevity. But a similar question was, once you're on a medication, should we increase the dose? Well, one reason would be if there's high blood pressure. We think that's deleterious to heart function to have high blood pressure. Obviously, if there's development of abnormal rhythm, we want to add a medication or increase a dose until we've controlled that rhythm problem. We might want to increase a medication if, despite our efforts, we're seeing decline in function. We may want to titrate up a dose until we're what we consider to be a maximum safe dose. And certainly if there are development of symptoms, we want to go up on doses until we, as best we can, alleviate. So what seems to work for stage one? We're now comfortable, I think, cardiologists that have taken care of a lot of muscular dystrophy patients, with the notion that starting an ACE inhibitor, such as anything that ends in pril, there's lots of different ones. If we start it relatively early, we can see a survival benefit. However, we have to acknowledge that this was done in a relatively small series of patients, and we'd like to see this in larger series replicated. But this has also been shown, these medications have been shown in multiple studies in adults and children with other forms of heart failure to improve outcome. So ACE inhibitors started early, we think, is a good idea. We're not so sure about how early to start. Roughly 10 is what was shown in the series from France, but maybe starting earlier is a better idea. How much to use? Should we just go with any old low dose? We don't really know. Is a similar class, ARB, Pat mentioned, angiotensin receptor blockers, are they as good as ACE inhibitors? If you have symptoms with ACE inhibitors that make, like, cough, makes them not tolerable, or are they even better? And there's some experimental data, some of it done by Ronald Cohen here at Hopkins in the MDX mouse, to suggest maybe those ARBs would have some biochemical properties that would be advantageous, but we're not sure yet in humans. And would the effect be better, the preventative effect, if we had more than one medication? We don't know. What else is working? So this is a really very important paper that came out of Montreal this year, showed that patients that had been treated with steroids, which were typically used to extend the period of ambulation, lived longer, had lower rates of new onset cardiomyopathy, and a slower decline in left ventricular ejection fraction and shortening fraction. Really important. We're now finding ourselves as cardiologists asking the neurologists about using steroids and how long to continue steroids. We're not really sure. Should we continue beyond the period of ambulation in the wheelchair because there may be some additional protective effect on the heart that is still has good function? We're not sure. How to treat? There's some studies looking into that, what doses and schedules and amounts. And what are the potentially negative effects of steroids, and how do we weigh those things against the benefits? So stage two, the declining function, typically we would add a beta blocker. And there's some data. There's lots of data in adults to show that this is a very important strategy to prolong life. The data in children with other forms of cardiomyopathy is a bit of a mixed bag because we have so many different types of cardiomyopathies in pediatrics, but most people believe that this is a helpful route. And specifically for muscular dystrophy, there are some papers showing some improvement in function, particularly if there's already some decline in function. What are we not sure about here? We're not sure whether this may ought to be on the early side. Would this be good in a preventative way? And is a faster heart rate, which is very common and typical in muscular dystrophy, even before there's heart dysfunction, is that alone a target that we should be going after? Should we try to bring the heart rate down? Would that be better? We're not sure. There's nothing to really hang our hat on, although there's some retrospective data suggest that that might be a good strategy, but we've got to weigh side effects, and we're not sure. Combination use with ACE inhibitors, it's thought that might be a good strategy, and people are starting to look at that now. Stage three, when the heart is seriously in decline, here we are starting to think about treating the secondary effects of bad heart failure, which is accumulation of fluid in the lungs. We might use diuretics. Digoxin is an old medication, but it helps the squeeze of the heart, and this may be a time to add that. Antiarrhythmics, as we mentioned before, this time patients are usually on beta blockers. We might want to titrate them up, look at other antiarrhythmics. If the heart is beating abnormally, we might want to add a medicine to prevent clots, which can form when the heart is not squeezing well, and such as aspirin. But again, at this stage, we have to look out for cross-reaction of medications, lower blood pressure, especially because our boys sometimes do not keep their fluid intake up. They'll either purposely try to avoid going to the bathroom, so limit the fluid they're taking, or they just don't have ready access to fluids throughout the day, and so this can run into difficulty with blood pressure medications that affect the status of the pressure. So kidney function also is a concern, and the kidney function in decline with the addition of medications that increase potassium can be a difficulty and can be dangerous. So something that we need to keep an eye on. So what other medications are being looked at? Phosphodiesterase inhibitors, sildenafil Rovatio. There was a trial here recently ended that you're going to hear some more from Catherine Wagner about later today. Tadalafil is being looked at. Antifibrotics, things that might change the course of the scar tissue formation, are being looked at. Eplerenone is in trial currently. Spironolactone is another medication. There's another antifibrotic that's being looked at, HT100. membrane sealants have some potential for improving the problem with inflammatory responses to calcium influx into the cell. And so these are all very exciting and potentially promising routes that will change the cardiac trajectory based on some early data, some data in the mouse model and some other preliminary data in humans. But the recommendations currently, and Linda and others were part of this from Pediatrics in 2005, are that patients should have a cardiac evaluation at diagnosis, echo and EKG. Patients should have a cardiac evaluation prior to any surgery every 2 years until age 10 and every year thereafter. We do stress echo or stress evaluations, usually stress MRI, prior to surgery, scoliosis-type surgery. And then this is what's gotten getting at here. Respiratory failure is common in DMD and should be treated aggressively. And many times I've seen, especially in older patients, heart symptoms that can be solved by seeing the pulmonologist, getting a sleep study, and starting BiPAP or increasing BiPAP. And the need for antiarrhythmics just suddenly kind of goes away. And that signs and symptoms should be treated, consideration be given to diuretics, which in the third stage would be important, ACE inhibitors in the first stage, and then beta blockers along the way. And that patients treated with steroids should be monitored more closely for the development of obesity and hypertension, and I would now add to consider the heart for that. Bottom line, cardiac medications and steroids are useful in DMD and heart failure. DMD has unique concerns for treatment, and new therapies are on the horizon and in clinical trials. And I just wanted to show my patient, Shane Lauer, mother and Shane, permitted me to use this picture. This is his father. This is Shane, who's now 21. This was done taken about a year ago, but he just completed a half marathon earlier this month. And I just like the look. They've both got their game faces on. And here he is, having finished the crossed the finish line. And this is an organization called Athletes Serving Athletes. It's based here in Maryland. And they have this wingman program that allows a crew to assist the athlete that is in the chair to complete even triathlons. Is quite amazing. And this has really changed this boy's life. He was a very timid, shy boy. It was really hard to interact. And lately, he comes into the office smiling. He's got a real sense of accomplishment and pride in what he's doing. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Reed. Next, we'll move to Naomi Cortez, who's the Director of Electrophysiology at Nationwide Children's Hospital, who's going to talk to you about heart rhythm disorders in Duchenne muscular dystrophy and the use of intracardiac defibrillators.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Linda and Kathy and Pat, for inviting me. And thank you for sharing your beautiful story about your son. We in medicine tend to forget that all those numbers in those studies, each of them have parents and siblings. Most people don't think I'm too quiet. Have parents and siblings, so thank you very much for that. So what I'm going to talk about today is Duchenne muscular dystrophy and sudden cardiac death. Does it happen, and how do we prevent it? So sudden cardiac death is actually one of the primary causes of death in adults. It is due to fast rhythms originating from the bottom chambers of the heart, causing a drop in blood pressure. These rhythms can cause fainting as well as sudden death. Now, just to review, what I do for a living every day is I'm basically a glorified electrician. So basically, in the top right chamber of the heart is the sinus node. It's the pacemaker of the heart. It tells the heart to speed up when you run and slow down when you're sleeping. It sends an electrical impulse that travels across the top two chambers like waves spread across water. Because electricity travels faster than muscle can contract, there's something called the AV node. The AV node slows the electrical impulse, allows the top chambers to finish beating, and sends the electrical impulse to the bottom chambers, thereby allowing the heart to act as an efficient pump with top, bottom, top, bottom. There are, however, backup pacemakers in the heart, and so this is actually what a normal electrocardiogram looks like, EKG, ECG, depending on whether you're in Germany or the U.S. And this little blip is the top chamber and the big spike is the bottom chamber. This is just an extra beat coming in. The problem is when you have heart failure and when you have scar in your heart, those backup pacemakers in the bottom chambers of the heart sometimes like to run the heart. The problem with that is you have fast rhythms coming from the bottom chambers and you disrupt the normal pump function of the heart, and this can lead to fainting and sudden cardiac death. This can also look quite irregular and, again, is very disruptive to maintaining any sort of blood pressure. So how do we decide who is at risk of developing these abnormal heartbeats and abnormal rhythms? So I'm going to have to give you a little bit of a history lesson in electrophysiology. This was really first looked at in patients who had history of heart attacks because they were known that even though they survived their heart attacks, that they had a high risk of sudden cardiac death. In other words, they were feeling fine and they died suddenly. What we found is that we could induce a life-threatening rhythm in the catheterization laboratory and therefore predict who is at risk. So if we took patients who had heart attacks to the cardiac cath lab and tried to induce a rhythm, if we could do it, they were at risk and we needed to do something about it, and if we couldn't, then they were theoretically safe. However, it was found over time that we actually didn't even have to go to the cath lab and that the best predictor of sudden cardiac death was poor cardiac function. Further studies were done to look at, well, what do we do if we know you're at risk of sudden cardiac death? And we looked at both medications as well as devices. And it was found that the best treatment to prevent sudden cardiac death was an implantable cardiac defibrillator. So what is an implantable cardiac defibrillator, which we call an ICD? An ICD is composed of three components. There's the device itself, there's the lead that goes in the heart, and then there's a programmer that we use to communicate with this device once it's implanted. The device itself is composed of two major things. It is the battery, as well as sort of the computer aspects of it. So when you have to change a device because of the battery being depleted, you actually have to change the whole device. We don't pop the battery out, pop a new battery in. We actually have to change the whole thing. The leads, however, stay. Implantable defibrillators are inserted in the cath lab. It's actually, we make an incision right under the clavicle, and we're able to access the vein, and we thread the lead into the heart itself. This is a chest x-ray of a patient with an implantable cardiac defibrillator. This device here sits under the skin. It's usually between the muscle and the fat. You can see here where there's this little bend that this is where the leads enter into the vessels, follow the vessels into the heart, and many times you'll have one lead in the top chamber and one lead in the bottom chamber. What does it do? Well, there are two components to a defibrillator. All defibrillators are pacemakers. So pacemakers treat slow heart rhythms. Defibrillators treat fast heart rhythms. All defibrillators also pace. So the lead in the top chamber is really meant for pacing only. It's only there to treat slow heart rhythms. The lead in the bottom chamber has a dual purpose. One, it can deliver energy and shock the heart out of an abnormal rhythm, but it also can pace the heart if the heartbeat is too slow. How does it do it? Well, the defibrillators have an aspect called sensing. It's what the device sees. So it's basically like wearing a seatbelt for rhythm disturbances. It's always there. It's always watching. It's making sure that the heart is beating appropriately. It looks at the electrical activity. That's what it's going to see. And it does that through the eyes of the device. And the eyes of the device are actually the lead itself, because the lead is actually what's in the heart monitoring what's going on. So it constantly watches the electrical activity. It sees or senses all electrical signals that pass by it. And a signal produced by a passing electrical wave is called an intracardiac electrogram. And that'll be important in just a minute. So what does it do if it sees an abnormal rhythm? So if it sees you've gone into a life-threatening rhythm, it actually discharges energy either between one coil and the device itself, or sometimes you have two coils, and it shocks the heart back into a normal rhythm. So the device will watch all the time. If it sees you going into a life-threatening rhythm, it says, wait a minute, I've detected it, I'm going to stop it. And then typically patients will either faint and then wake up and feel fine. We can actually monitor what the device is doing at all times, and the device actually stores a lot of information for us so we know what has been going on. This is an example of an appropriately detected event. So here you have the little white squares and the black squares. That's the top and bottom chambers. You can see that they're beating together. They're doing fine. And then all of a sudden, the black squares are going much faster than the white squares, and you've gone into an abnormal rhythm. The device has detected that this rhythm is abnormal. It's delivered energy and restored normal rhythm. You notice that this time is in seconds. So it actually detects it within 12 seconds and then stops it. This is what the intracardiac electrogram, so sometimes we worry, well, are we sure that what it thought it saw is what it saw? We can actually print out tracings that are similar to ECGs. So the top is the top chamber, the bottom is the bottom chamber. All those spikes show you how fast this is going. This is actually going at about 300 beats a minute. Here is where the device shocked the heart and restored normal rhythm. So based on that, you would think everybody should get a defibrillator. They sound pretty good. Everybody has to wear a seatbelt, so everybody has to have a defibrillator. Well, it's not that simple. So the imperfection of defibrillators is you actually need anesthesia for implantation, so that in patients with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is not a small walk in the park. The devices are very good, but they're not perfect, and sometimes they get confused and will shock normal rhythms. And this can feel like either being hit in the chest or kicked in the chest by a horse, is how some of my patients have described it. The leads themselves are not perfect. If you've been following the media, these are some of the devices that have had recalls because the leads that we thought would work develop complications and have to be removed. In addition, we found that there's a psychological impact to having a defibrillator. Some patients are very comforted by having it. Some patients are frightened by it, and they know that there's something in their chest that could fire, and they're always worried that it's going to go off. And at the end of the day, we have to remember one thing about defibrillators. They don't treat the cardiomyopathy. They are there as sort of a secondary backup. They will do nothing to help the muscle function. They will do nothing to prevent the rhythms from happening. They're just there if they happen to have an abnormal rhythm. So then we have to decide, what are the indications for these devices? Who should we put them in? So in order to answer that question, we have to ask, what's the incidence of sudden cardiac death? And can we figure out who's at risk of it? So I'm going to again go back to my history lesson. This is a study called the Sudden Cardiac Death and Heart Failure Trial. This was done in 2,521 patients with left ventricular ejection fractions less than or equal to 35%, which in medicine is what is considered severe heart failure. These patients were followed for 4 years. Now, of note, number one, there were 2,500 patients. That's going to become important. Two, the median age was 60. 1,200 of them had cardiomyopathy not due to a heart attack. And what they found was ICDs reduced the overall mortality by 23%. In other words, if you had severely depressed heart function, an ICD could potentially save your life. Okay, so that makes perfect sense. So the current recommendations for ICD implantation are patients who've already had a sudden cardiac arrest, otherwise known as sudden secondary prevention, meaning you've already demonstrated that you can do this, so clearly we have to do something about it. And also patients with severely depressed cardiac function. So even if you've never had any rhythm problem, if you have severely depressed function, we know that you're at risk of developing these rhythms, and therefore we're going to put this in prophylactically, and we call that primary prevention. But now let's go back for a second, because I just mentioned that these were 60-year-olds, okay? That's not the typical age of patients with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. So Vivian Dimas and I reviewed all the patients with the idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy seen at Texas Children's Hospital over 14 years. Remember when I said that 2,500 number? So over 14 years at Texas Children's Hospital, which is one of the largest pediatric hospitals, we had 85 patients. So just a slightly different number. Their median age was 3.8 years. Their mean ejection fraction was 25%, so still very sick hearts. there was one episode of sudden cardiac death, or 1%. So clearly the disease in children and the disease in adults is not the same disease. In addition, how many times does the device get confused, and how often does it discharge when it's not supposed to? So Charlie Barrell evaluated 443 patients with ICDs with a median age of 16 years. So we're now getting into more of the age group that typically you're going to have cardiac dysfunction in Duchenne's at four large pediatric institutions. There was inappropriate shocks, and what that means is the device shouldn't have gone off, in 87 of 409 patients, or 21%. There was a mean of 6 per patient, or a median of 4, and mainly these were due to lead failure or incorrect diagnosis of the arrhythmia. 24% of patients less than 18 years experienced at least one inappropriate shock, compared with 14% in adults. And there were adults in this study because this was also included patients with congenital heart disease. So you can see that not only are the kids different in their incidence of sudden cardiac death, but the incidence of complications in younger patients is also higher. So kids are not adults. The incidence of sudden cardiac death in children and adolescents with dilated cardiomyopathy is much lower than in adults. The role of prophylactic placement of an ICD or primary prevention is less clear. There's a higher risk of complications both with the procedure and following the procedure. So where does that leave us? So what about sudden cardiac death in patients with muscular dystrophy? Why don't we review all the studies looking at that? Well, as we like to say, Houston, we have a problem. There are no studies looking at that. We don't know the answers. So what do we know about sudden cardiac death in Duchenne's muscular dystrophy? There's no data on the incidence of ventricular arrhythmias. There's no data on the incidence of sudden cardiac death. So currently, the use of implantable defibrillators is based on data obtained from patients with a mean age of 60 years with a different reason for their cardiomyopathy. Therefore, in conclusion, implantable cardiac defibrillators do prevent sudden cardiac death. However, the risk of sudden cardiac death in Duchenne muscular dystrophy is unknown, and the decision to place an ICD for primary prevention must take into account not only the risk of sudden death, but the risk of ICD implantation, inappropriate discharge, and lead complications. And because of that, Linda and I are starting a new study on sudden cardiac death in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, the incidence and prevention. We will be submitting it to the IRB in the next few months, and we will be asking for patients and families to enroll in this so we can answer this question, so we can find out when and should we use implantable defibrillators in this patient population. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. We're going to change it up just a little bit because of technical issues and the need for Dr. Morales to use his own laptop, but I do need to pull up one thing before that. So the next person who's going to be talking is Charlie Cantor, who is here from Washington University in St. Louis, who's going to be talking to us about pediatric transplantation. But before we do that, I want to share with you something that Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy has undertaken recently. And I'm going to read this to you. It may make Dr. Cantor's talk just a little bit more interesting. This is a letter. I think that you may not be aware of the fact that your organization, Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, is constantly working 24/7 to advocate for you and your families. And this is a letter that was drafted and sent and announced in a press release, I think at the end of last week, on behalf of children with muscular dystrophy. Can we make it big? Make it a size, can I get bigger?
Like the font, actually.
Okay, I guess it is.
Like that, you mean?
Or actually, yeah, that would be good. Actually, perfect. And I'm just going to read it out loud, and you guys can read along with me. This is written to the Secretary of Department of Human Services. Secretary of Health and Human Services Department, Kathleen Sebelius. We applaud your recent request to the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network to review its policy regarding the availability of an adult lung transplant for children less than 12 years of age. And you may know that of the case of the young woman, the young girl with cystic fibrosis who was advocating for an adult-sized organ. It was widely in the press over the last several weeks. We certainly hope that this will be helpful, along with the federal court intervention for Sarah and many other children in a similar situation. In particular, we urge you to move this initiative into a broader dialogue for other children and families confronting similar antiquated transplant policies in diseases such as muscular dystrophy. As you know, muscular dystrophy is a group of diseases marked by progressive dysfunction of skeletal and cardiac muscle. Duchenne and Becker muscular dystrophy is the most common pediatric form of muscular dystrophy. Currently, the prevalence of Duchenne muscular dystrophy is 1 in 5,000 to 7,000 males ages 5 through 24 in the United States. In 2007, 58% of these individuals lived to be 20 to 24 years of age with heart failure due to severe dilated cardiomyopathy as a major cause of death. Today, the average lifespan is 28 years, and novel therapies on the horizon to extend the lifespan by decades. Under current procedures, cardiologists operating according to the protocols of their hospital first determine which patients should be evaluated as potential organ recipients. The hospital transplant committee reviews all patients submitted for transplant. If the patient is determined to be a suitable candidate for transplant by the hospital transplant committee, the patient is added to the transplant center's waiting list through the United Network for Organ Sharing, UNOS, computer, and awaits for a potential organ donor. The policy most often invoked in denying transplant evaluations to patients with Becker or Duchenne muscular dystrophy states that patients are excluded from the transplant list with the presence of any non-cardiac condition that significantly shortens life expectancy compared with that expected with cardiac transplantation or in conjunction with immunosuppression requirements, which importantly reduces the expected survival after transplantation. And this was taken from the pediatric heart transplant text. The medical community has historically perceived Duchenne to be one of these life-shortening diagnoses. Systemic diseases have been considered a contraindication to cardiac transplant. And traditionally, muscular dystrophies have been placed into that category. However, cardiac transplantation has been used in patients with Becker muscular dystrophy in which there was no substantial limitations in respiratory muscle strength and underlying skeletal myopathy, and had a slow progressive course. Over the past 10 years, several patients with both Duchenne and Becker muscular dystrophy have undergone successful cardiac transplants and are doing quite medically well and living with an excellent quality of life. Pediatric and adolescent hearts available for transplant are scarce, and life post-transplant is not a panacea. We acknowledge that there must be appropriate use of this precious resource for appropriate patients with clear and full patient and parent understanding of the risks and benefits entailed with cardiac transplant. However, clearly, traditional contraindication should not be an absolute contraindication to transplant. The recent tragic case of Mitchell Jones, an 11-year-old man with severe dilated cardiomyopathy but no significant limitations in respiratory or musculoskeletal strength, illustrates this need for change. Mitchell was denied a heart transplant purely due to his underlying diagnosis of Duchenne. His father, Chris Jones, in an online blog archiving international acclaim, Mitchell's Journey, eloquently chronicled this tragic story and did so for us this morning. Mitchell's experience is a compelling example of the need to change in antiquated transplant policies, which demonstrates that each case should be evaluated individually without the bias of underlying diseases, such as the case with Duchenne, or of age, such as the case with the young woman with cystic fibrosis, Sarah. Unfortunately, Mitchell is not alone in this frustrating odyssey. It is our goal to change understanding in the community at large regarding Becker and Duchenne muscular dystrophy and other rare diseases regarding the equitable distribution of available organs to individuals for whom they are appropriate. We hope that Mitchell's story and others will serve to enlighten the medical community as to the need for to individually evaluate transplant candidates according to the need and without unjustified bias. I am certain certain we agree that no child should be denied access to any therapy or procedure which will extend or enhance either length or quality of life. Thank you for your leadership in this critical effort. I look forward to learning how you can support comprehensive transplant policy reform for children. Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy stands ready to support you in any way possible. So on that note, I'd like to introduce Dr. Cantor.
Well, it is my pleasure to address you, and I appreciate Ms. Kennett allowing me to come up here without a suit and tie, because this is the way I usually dress when I'm in the hospital or around. I'm more comfortable in this situation. So I have seen this letter, and I appreciate Dr. Kripe presenting it to you, and I will comment on it after I finish my presentation, because I think it deserves a response. First of all, there's very little in the medical literature about use of heart transplantation therapy in muscular dystrophy patients. And I guess before I start, I should probably give disclosures. Generally, when we talk at medical meetings these days, we have to disclose who supports our research or who paid our travel, and et cetera. So my disclosure to you is, while I do run the heart transplant service at St. Louis Children's Hospital, and we've transplanted pediatric patients there since 1986, and done over 400 pediatric heart transplants there, these days, we consider ourselves mainly a cardiomyopathy and heart failure service, of which transplantation is just one of the therapies that we use. And personally, I get more out of preventing or delaying transplants than doing them. And I think I could say I could speak for the rest of the pediatric cardiologists around the country who engage in pediatric heart failure. We're a small group, but we work very well together and actually, quite honestly, have been extraordinarily productive with understanding all pediatric cardiomyopathies, including dystrophin, cardiomyopathies due to dystrophin mutation. So with that disclosure, when I gave this talk, I really did a literature search to try to find out what had been published on it. And aside from isolated case reports of transplants, mainly for the Becker's variant of dystrophin mutation, this is the only relatively large, though it's small, case series in the literature. And this series came from an entity called the Cardiac Transplant Research Database, which is a consortium of adult transplant centers around the country that was organized down in Alabama, Birmingham. And you should note here that in terms of awareness, the authors, and this was published in the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation 3 years ago, but of note, I'll show you the fourth author on the list, Clyde Yancey, is the current president of the American Heart Association and a very well-renowned adult heart failure expert. So, and you can see from this experience in these adult groups, they actually found among their thousands of adult heart transplant patients, 29 adults, which are over the age of 18, who were transplanted with muscular dystrophy. And you can see here they were primarily the Becker's variant of dystrophin mutations, though interestingly, three with Duchenne's and a few with other types of muscular dystrophies. And overall, their age of transplant was around 37 years of age. They actually did this the proper way and matched within their database these 29 to 275 patients with idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathies, meaning they didn't know the reason why they had the cardiomyopathy, so that they tried to make sure that the other mitigating factors on outcome didn't exist. And you can see on the slide on the right panel, the outcome after transplantation was identical in the muscular dystrophy patients to the matched control group, though you can also see that it's true with any survival curve after heart transplantation, the curve generally is not flat, it continues to decline. Heart transplantation is generally a time-limited disease. The way it's looked at is transplant half-lives, which is the time that half the patients who are transplanted either die or need another organ. In adults, the average is about 12 to 15 years. In children, we do a little better, though adolescents are about what are adults. Infants, when they're transplanted, do the best. And in this day, for those infants who survive in the first year after transplant, the half-life has yet to be determined. It extends over 20 years. But for the most part, the underscore is that that is not a cure. In many ways, what we tell our transplant patients is when you transplant somebody, you exchange a fatal disease for a chronic disease. And that's with a definite ongoing mortality. But then again, they went ahead and also looked at some other of the main problems with transplantation, which are rejection and infections. You can see here that actually the muscular dystrophy recipients did better than the control group with rejection and did about the same with infections. Which infections? These were infections that were serious enough to require IV antibiotics or hospitalization, so pretty comparable. These folks then included, and I included here the last two paragraphs of the conclusion from the paper. So I thought it was best to, you know, as you can see here, that this group of authors, and these are prominent heart transplant physicians, as you see, that the long-term clinical outcomes in selected patients, these are adults with muscular dystrophy, are similar to the matched cohort of patients undergo transplant adults for idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathies. However, the results of this investigation must be taken in the context there was likely a selection bias in the MD in this study, because this study was limited by the lack of information they had within a cardiac database about the functional capacity, i.e. skeletal muscle myopathies, of the patient who underwent transplantation. However, their final paragraph was recognizing the limitations of this study. One can conclude that a diagnosis of muscular dystrophy should not be the sole factor excluding these patients from consideration of a cardiac transplant. For each patient, consideration should be given to the extent of skeletal myopathy, respiratory muscle involvement, and anticipated life expectancy. Further studies to identify the optimal criteria for selection in postoperative care of muscular dystrophy patients are warranted. So what do we do in St. Louis? And I would say that we do know a little bit, and we have done a little bit of evaluating dystrophin cardiomyopathies in the pediatric heart failure world. For the last 20 years, we've been part in St. Louis, and Dr. Morales's folks in Cincinnati and at Texas, where he came from initially, have been involved with what's been called the Pediatric Cardiomyopathy Registry, which was an organized registry supported by the National Institute of Health to evaluate the natural history of cardiomyopathies. And that's been shared over that period of time by Steve Lipschultz and Jeff Tobin and Steve Colin at Boston. We've been part of it as well. And in that registry, unlike other national registries such as the Australian registry, they made a decision to include patients with muscular dystrophy. So we do have a fair amount of data on the natural history of muscular dystrophy. Within that, we found what Dr. Cortez found in Texas overall, that the risk of sudden death actually is very low and much lower than it is in the adults. So, but we also are aware, as I said, that when we do it in St. Louis, and we work in very close conjunction with our skeletal muscle colleagues, and we have, as probably most of you know, we have a very large muscular dystrophy center in St. Louis. The muscle expert who works there, Ann Connolly, in children, she and I work very close together, and I would say over the last years there's an increasing awareness of cardiomyopathies as a part of research and diagnosis in all muscular dystrophies. As many people have gone, into bringing a cardiologist into the routine management of these patients well before they develop symptoms, or certainly before even the echocardiograms become abnormal. Based on the French study that Dr. Thompson referred to, which I think was compelling, we begin now early treatment of steroids and ACE inhibition or angiotensin receptor blockaders at the time of diagnosis. There is evidence and there is recent research that suggests well before you see any change in the echocardiograms that there is evidence of fibrosis in the hearts at a very early age. Thus, the idea that the cardiomyopathies start in adolescence, I personally think, is erroneous. They are there from an early age. In fact, they may actually be there from the time the diagnosis is made in the skeletal muscle. In the American Heart Association classes four stages of heart failure. Stage A heart failure they describe as conditions that lead to a high risk of heart failure. Clearly, any patient who has a dystrophin mutation fits, regardless of their symptoms and regardless of what their hearts look like, the classification of stage A heart failure. Stage B heart failure represents those patients who have abnormal cardiac tests, echocardiograms, but have no symptoms of heart failure. Stage C is patients who have symptomatic heart failure. Stage D are symptoms at rest or really end-stage heart failure. In many ways, patients with dystrophin mutations come to us much earlier than other genetic cardiomyopathies because they have a diagnosis well before the echoes become abnormal. And based on the findings from France, we believe that stage A heart failure in dystrophin mutation should be treated, and the initial treatment should be ACE inhibition or ARBs if you can't tolerate the ACE inhibitors. We initiate beta blockade when the left ventricular function becomes abnormal, which we define as less than 50%, 50 to 55%, regardless of symptoms. And the reason why we know that is once they're in our group, we see them yearly and follow them with not just echoes. There are other markers of cardiac performance you can test by blood, which are helpful as well. And when we see those, regardless of symptoms, we add carvedilol at the onset of stage B heart failure. I will tell you that the combination of carvedilol and ACE inhibitors has been shown in multiple adult studies to reduce morbidity and mortality in adult heart failure. And then as things come up, we use all the tools we possibly have to treat heart failure if those symptoms occur. The best example of that I have since individual patients is we had a 15-year-old who went to our hospital with a really bad arrhythmia from his cardiomyopathy. He was pretty sick, and it turned out his father was a former publisher of the Post-Dispatch, the big newspaper in St. Louis, and he was sick enough that we talked about transplant. However, we had another option at the time where you use pacemakers to improve heart function as well as to control rhythms. And he turned out to be the first patient we ever used biventricular pacing on at St. Louis Children's Hospital. He graduated to the adult people, so I don't really see him anymore as a patient. I see him, quite honestly, I see him every now and then at the Blues games since I go to the Blues games, and he occasionally goes. And while he's now he was wheelchair-bound then, he's not on a home ventilator, but gosh, he has to be in his late 20s with his BiV pacemaker. And that's just an example of how sometimes acute heart failure things can happen. And you can find ways for people who are really sick to avoid transplantation. And so that's, as far as transplants go, I think our position on transplants for dystrophin mutations is no different than any other patient that comes to us for transplantation. We evaluate each patient on a case-by-case basis at the time of their failure of oral medical therapy. Now, it turns out we can't escape the fact that there are comorbidities with dystrophin mutations, unlike other genetic cardiomyopathies where the heart is the only muscle affected. They are, and they can affect success of this therapy and might impact on the chronic disease which someone has who's a transplant recipient. There are rare cases of cardiac-specific dystrophin mutations where it's the mutations only in the heart, not in the muscle. We actually transplanted two brothers for that a number of years ago. But that's pretty rare. But again, I would emphasize that we do this on a case-by-case basis. And in the letter that Linda read to you, she referred to a monograph and also to a circulation position, which was the indications for pediatric heart transplantation for pediatric heart disease. I'm well aware of those two publications since I was the co-editor of the monograph, and I was the chairman of the writing committee for the AHA scientific statement. So I will point, and when I read this letter, it struck me that I didn't remember that we had put anything in there specifically about Duchenne's. So I reread both of them because I'm getting old and my memory's failing me, and I didn't see anything related to putting in there specifically that we did not say that Duchenne's per se was a contraindication to a transplant. What we did put in the scientific statement was reference to a couple of case reports that specifically said that cardiac transplantation could be successful in cardiomyopathies from Becker's muscular dystrophy. So I wrote it. I think I know what it says. So anyway, so that's how we view transplantation in St. Louis. In saying that, I think when I started in this business, I, like a lot of cardiologists, you saw Becker's and Duchenne's. And I initially, when I put this slide together, I thought, well, it's a black or white, either or. But I thought that was inappropriate because you'd obviously put the black arrow with the Duchenne's and the Becker's with the white, and I'm not sure that's fair. So I changed colors. But the bottom line, what I wanted to show about this is very often it seems like people tend to categorize dystrophinopathies one way or another. It's one, Becker's and Duchenne's, and they go in different directions. After having evaluated these folks for now, gosh, over 25 years, my personal view is like this. It's a spectrum. And the skeletal muscle people talk about Becker's and they talk about Duchenne's. And a lot of times what they don't talk about, what you only find out, are what they refer to as in-betweeners. And the bottom, but I think from our perspective in the heart failure business, I look upon dystrophin mutations now. There's some that have minimal to no skeletal myopathy, but mostly present with heart failure. And then there's ones that go through various degrees of either or. And finally, there are certainly some whose hearts do very well for decades, but have awful skeletal muscle. Problems, and I have no idea how to separate them. I don't think anybody else does. But it's very clear it's not an either-or phenomenon. It's a spectrum, and so that's why I think more than anything else, you have to treat each patient as their own and look at their specific disease. Because each patient, I think, likely in this entity doesn't have, if you're going to put a name to it, they don't have Duchenne's or Becker's. They have the disease that they exist with their person. And that's what you have to evaluate one by one. So saying that, this is what we've done in St. Louis, as you can see, since 86. We've transplanted 8 patients who have a combination of cardiomyopathy and skeletal myopathy with dystrophin mutations. Of those, 6 were felt to be Becker's, and 2 were felt to be Duchenne's. The 2 Duchenne's did have some degree of ambulation, minimal amounts, but they did ambulate. Of the 6 Beckers, I will tell you that 2 of them, we in the heart failure service, made the diagnosis of Beckers at the time they presented in heart failure. You usually try to find the reason for it. They came in with bad echoes. They or their families did not perceive themselves to be weak or functionally impaired except for their heart symptoms. Yet when you measured their blood CPKCs, they were elevated. And when they got the skeletal muscle biopsies, they were abnormal. So certainly one of the spectrum of Becker's is that the heart failure doctors make the diagnosis of muscular dystrophy. And so of those 8 patients, 100% have survived. All of them went to the adult transplant folks, and except for the few that are under 18, we don't see them anymore. And they were all less than 18 years at transplant. 2 of the Becker's, three of the Becker's are all great. I mean, one of the Beckers played high school baseball after his heart transplant. His skeletal myopathy was that mild. He became an engineering student. He was from Chicago and came to us for an insurance thing. He went to Washington University as an engineering student. He'd come by every now and then to volunteer at the hospital. The other one, the first one we did, actually turned out to after his transplant to come to Washington, D.C., and was a U.S. Senate page. And he called us up when he was there because he was worried about his heart because he was tired all the time. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, you're 19. How late are you going to bed at night? Oh, I usually go to bed about 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, what time do you get up? Well, I have to get up around 6. I said, well, I know why you're tired now. I think probably you're fine. And another one right now is in college in Florida becoming a recording engineer. But they have minimal, and, you know, the most recent Duchesne was a guy from Nebraska who's 14, we did 2 years ago, who's still alive. I think is the last, we don't follow him directly, but I think at this point he still has some degree of he can ambulate a little bit. So, you know, that's how I see it. I think that's the way many transplant people see it. I would tell you that I think that there is a lot going on. There's a lot of appreciation about heart disease and dystrophinopathies. There are 2 or 3 trials right on board with new therapies where not just the skeletal muscles will be evaluated, but the hearts will as well. And so I think, you know, from our perspective in the heart failure field, we're excited about this because we know that the diseases we deal with are very rare. And ironically, dystrophin mutations are one of the more common causes of genetic cardiomyopathies we see. They're all rare diseases. They're all small numbers. It's hard to figure out. But we think that there's going to be things from studying these folks that will apply to all of our patients with cardiomyopathies. And I appreciate the opportunity to hear and speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. I think that was outstanding. And having been at this conference now for maybe 10 years, I think that that was a very important conversation and presentation for this patient population. And so I really, really thank you because, you know, I think that the community needs to hear that pediatric heart transplantation is an option. And I think you did a very nice job of representing that. The next speaker will be Dr. David Morales from Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And we're going to have the opportunity to hear about the use of ventricular assist devices in this patient population. Dr. Morales has considerable expertise in this regard and has been a tremendous advocate for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So are you... He's logging in, so we'll be ready to go in just a couple of seconds. I think we're late on time. How late are we?
So we go to 10, but that was question Q&A, so
we'll just stop it. We'll just eliminate the question session then after. Okay, so we're late on time, but so after this we'll have just maybe 1 or 2 questions, and I believe that a number of the speakers have agreed to stay through the lunch session, and there'll be a room provided. So we're going to be up in here in the front right corner at lunch, and I'm not sure who's going to be able to stay and who's not, but some of us will be here. Oh, we're going to be out in the hall in the right corner. Oh, so where we rate. Okay, different venue. After this session or at lunchtime? At lunchtime, we'll be out in the hall in the right corner. Okay, anyway, Dr. Morales looks like he's ready, so we'll go.
Well, I want to thank everyone for inviting me to share some of my thoughts on Duchenne's muscular dystrophy and the use of ventricular assist devices. And in regards to awareness, so I started becoming interested in this a few years ago, and it would always be part of my talks, and I had not actually placed one of these devices in a Duchenne's patient, but I've probably been talking about it for 4 or 5 years. Fortunately, we were able to do so this year, but after that, I would say at every major transplant meeting or VAD meeting, I have been asked to talk about Duchenne's and VADs. So I think that the community as a whole is very aware of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy and the new things that we can do for that. So what is a VAD? A VAD is a ventricular assist device. It connects to the heart to augment the pumping function of the heart. So it doesn't oxygenate the blood. It doesn't do anything. It just does the pumping function of the heart. It can be extracorporeal. It means sits away from the body. It can be paracorporeal, which means sits on the body. Or the device can be intracorporeal, which actually sits in the body. And this shouldn't be confused with a total artificial heart. That's when you actually take the heart out and put a machine in that replaces the heart. Again, this is attaches to the heart. So this is a picture of a VAD. As you can see, it attaches to the heart. So an LVAD, a left ventricular assist device, takes blood out of the left ventricle, puts it through a machine, and then pumps it back into the aorta. Whereas an RVAD does the same thing for the right side, takes the blood out of the right ventricle and pushes it into the pulmonary artery. So my first thoughts about this population actually started back in Texas when I was there in about 2008. So, you know, I did my training in general surgery and cardiac surgery and then pediatric heart surgery, but Duchenne's is not something I knew anything really about. We had this thing called morning report. And morning report is where the cardiology fellows would tell us about every patient in the hospital with heart problems. And I would hear about the Duchenne's patients being admitted for their titration and medication. And they would actually not go to the cardiac ICU. They would go to the pediatric ICU because they were more familiar with these patients and had to take care of all their other issues. So I actually never would see the patients. I would just hear about them every morning. And I would get familiar with their names, and they would come in and out. But eventually, you know, unfortunately, I would always hear the same, that they would be placed on Milrinone, and then eventually they would be sent out, and that there was nothing more that we could do for them. And again, we also would look at these patients as individuals in firm regards to transplant, but the vast, vast majority of them were not considered transplant candidates. So really, that's when I started being introduced to this population. I then found out that even though these patients were living great lives, full lives with them and their families, about anywhere from 50 to 70% of them would actually die of heart failure. And about this time in 2008, we had a huge change in ventricular assist devices. We started having these second and third generation devices. And the reason these devices were different in that they could last, the way they were created, that they could last for many years, not just 2 or 1 year. And before, VADs were just used as a bridge to get to transplant. So if patients were too sick to wait for their transplant, we used to put these devices in, and that would bridge them to transplant. When the second and third generation devices started coming, people started to realize that these devices actually could last quite a long time. And they used and now the indication was to destination, meaning that they actually weren't going for transplant. And to be honest, the majority of large transplant centers, if you're 30 years old and you have heart failure, you're probably going to get a VAD and not be put on the transplant list. So, you know, although I've always been involved in heart transplants, and it's something that I think obviously is a wonderful therapy, it is not an answer, and it is not a cure, and it is not necessarily the best place to go now, actually. And you can see that throughout adult heart failure, because it's really the use of VADs that has taken over. Most transplant centers put in many more VADs and follow many more patients per year now than they do transplants. And the various VADs that are available, these are the three devices that we've obtained. This is the HeartMate 2. It's a long-term VAD. As you can see, the reason these VADs used to be air-actuated, so it used to be a pump to push air in and out. But now with newer technology, this is a magnet that changes polarity. So the turbine inside actually doesn't actually touch anything. So there's no heat production and there's no wear. So how long can these VADs go? We don't know. There's hundreds over 5 years. There are some over 7 years. And we don't know because they've only been around that long. These are intracorporeal. They're noiseless. But as you can see, there is something that comes outside of the body, a transcutaneous power drive. But this is also changing. There's now new technology being developed. Will it be transcutaneous, meaning that there will be actually nothing that penetrates the skin at all? So for a long time, when I was at Texas, we became the first place to actually have the HeartMate 2 as an independent pediatric program. It really changed how we looked at VADs. Again, we no longer just looked at them to get to transplant. We started to realize there were patient populations and other children who actually could be having these devices and going home and living with these devices and allow them to go home. And that was a big change. And that really in pediatric hospitals, which are places where a lot of Duchenne's patients are obviously taken care of, that transition still hasn't happened, thinking of VADs as actually destination therapy. This is another device. This is called a HeartWare. This is a third-generation device. Again, it's magnetically levitated, much smaller. And if you notice, sorry to go back, this device sits way outside. It's still inside the body but needs a pocket. You have to create a little area in which to place the HeartMate, whereas in the HeartWare, there is no pocket. It sits right on the heart. It actually sits within the cavity where the heart is, which is called the pericardium. This device, when we got, you know, this is a 9-year-old. This allows us now to offer these second and third generation devices to smaller children. And then you have the Jarvik 2000, which is a continuous axial flow pump, and this is very interesting. So as you see, we had a pump that was needed a pocket, but inside the body. Then we had a pump that was actually on the heart, and this is interesting because this is a pump that is actually inside the heart. So this is the pumping mechanism here. And so, you know, and so all of these devices may have their use for specific patients depending on their body habitus and how far they are along in their Duchenne's. And as you notice, the sizes are getting smaller. This is the HeartMate and this is the HeartWare. So industry is also motivated. I work with all these companies except Jarvik, I guess that's my disclosure, to develop smaller devices. This is the HeartMate 3 and this is the HeartMate X, which looks much like the Jarvik. This is the MVAD from the HeartWare company, and then this is the Circulate. We just have 2 grants now with FDA. This device is smaller than a AA battery, right? And so there is a lot of motivation to continually get smaller devices. So, you know, it is important to think that, as we all know with our phones and everything else, technology will only get better. So the fact that we have already started using these devices, the technology with these devices will only get better. And really, you know, I always say that one of my goals is by the time, and this isn't just for Duchenne's, but this would be for any children with heart failure, really transplant will only be done selectively. Right, the ability to place a device and have that in for 10, 12 years and then pull another device and exchange it is probably not more than a decade away. As you guys all know, Duchenne's patients grow up realizing that they will develop heart failure, and their families know that, and they go through this progression. And so with this emergence of these second and third generation devices, I started to think, you know, why can't we change this? Right, why can't we place the devices? Maybe they can't go for transplant, but maybe they can have a device. This was a paper written. So at this time, I actually, again, around 2009, started thinking and talking about the possibility. I have a friend called Nina Amadeo who is in Rome. He actually works within the Vatican. There's a children's hospital in the Vatican itself. And Babina Jasui, and we had been talking about this, and he actually went ahead and did the first patient ever with Duchenne's. It was a 15-year-old that had been admitted repeatedly for heart failure, and he put a Jarvik 2000 in. He was extubated within 24 hours. He did have some bleeding, had to go back, and had respiratory support for 2 months, but was discharged after 2 months after surgery. He returned to his baseline activity and attended school, and I was fortunate enough to be asked to go to visit the hospital and talk, and I met him, actually, and this is him, he's the first Duchenne's patient ever to have a VAD. Nino did a second case soon after, and this is interesting. It's a 14-year-old boy who also had heart failure, and actually they had already spoken to the family about a VAD, and they had decided not to go forward. But then, unfortunately, the boy came in and arrested He was placed on ECMO. ECMO is a device that takes over the function of the heart and the lungs. It's a very, really it takes over all of those functions, and so it has a lot of morbidity with it. But fortunately, some of the function of the right ventricle, because again, we're only supporting the left ventricle, not really the right ventricle, got better. And then off ECMO, Nino actually placed a device. And this was quite brave of him. I'm not sure I would have taken that challenge on. But this patient was also extubated. Now, he had multiple complications postoperatively and took him quite a long time to get out of the hospital. He eventually had a tracheostomy and was discharged after 7 months. So again, you know, when you come in that sick, even when you get a device in your heart function, the rest of your body has to catch up, and it can take quite a long time. A very important lesson, and that we're now finding out is we've done a couple of Duchenne's patients, is, you know, these patients are being placed with VADs. So most pediatric hospitals don't have a lot of experience with VADs. However, they have a lot of experience with Duchenne's. And so when these patients are out in the community and not close to you, because we have patients coming from many states away, who do you partner with? Who do you partner with in terms of, do you partner with an adult hospital who knows about VADs, or do you partner with a pediatric hospital that knows about Duchenne's? And unfortunately, they went for a bronchoscopy, and this patient ended up dying after a simple case. And so it really demonstrates that either you have to bring that patient back to your hospital, where supposedly you have an expertise in both, or you have to find that partner. And it really, I think it's beholden on us now to find that partner before you place the device. You need to make sure that they can go back home and live at their house, and that you have a partner close that they can go to where you feel comfortable and you have good dialogue. And that's very important, I think. As you guys know, that Cincinnati is fortunate to have a large Duchenne's clinic. And, you know, I had thought a lot about it in Texas. But, you know, placing the device is one thing. Taking care of these children before and after is another thing. And even though Texas has a Duchenne's clinic, it wasn't really that till I came to Cincinnati that I really felt comfortable moving forward, and that I felt I was surrounded by the expertise that would be needed to take care of a child with this. And that, you know, what I really wanted to make sure is that we moved forward with this therapy and that we were successful. And so I wanted to be in the best environment perhaps to make that happen. And we also have, you know, a very large cardiomyopathy program that we're already seeing a lot of Duchenne's patients. So we had a lot of patients that were potential who were coming from many countries, states. So how do we evaluate these Duchenne's patients? So one is we do this new thing called virtual surgery, and I do this really for all of the devices I place, as well as the total artificial hearts I place. You know, these are basically adult devices, and we're pushing the limits of how to place them in children. So we have to make sure they're going to fit. And if we just follow the normal regulations, you know, we wouldn't do half the cases that we do. But we also want to be safe. So, you know, one of our cardiologist who specializes in imaging, called Michael Taylor, had helped create some software where we can do virtual surgery. So basically, they take a 3D reconstruction of the device, and then they do a 3D reconstruction of the chest and the heart, and then I go in there and I tell Mike where I'm going to put things or where I'm going to cut things out, and he puts the device in, and then he puts the chest wall around it, and then I can see if it fits. And that's very important, especially perhaps with Duchenne's, with you know, with the different body habitus they can have, to make sure it's actually going to fit well. We do, obviously, a lot of other studies, swallow GI studies, social work, psychology, financial. We all have all our patients who are being assessed, seen by palliative care, really not because of palliative care, but they are wonderful in discussing the options and therapies that are available to them and seeing what they really want. And so this is some of the three. Now, unfortunately, I got the wrong slide. This is a total artificial heart that we actually did. So, but it's the same concept of taking out the heart or placing things on the heart and then putting it within that patient's body habitus to see if it fits. So who are we evaluating? Duchenne's patients with chronic heart failure who are inotrope dependent. right now is who we're evaluating. Decrease in cardiac function, plus or minus symptoms, and we've talked about this, they don't always have symptoms. No significant end organ dysfunction, no end-stage renal failure or liver failure, and stable pulmonary function with or without positive pressure. And again, you know, when we're making these criteria, this is just an interdisciplinary group coming together and thinking about what are the criteria for now. I'm sure these will be changing over the years of who we're evaluating. But what we thought are these are – this criteria is clearly for a patient who does not have Duchenne's an indication for VAD. If you're a 25-year-old and you're on inotrope, you will probably be getting a VAD at most heart failure centers if you're living on an inotrope. So this is clearly an indication for a 25-year-old without Duchenne's, so it should be the same for a patient with Duchenne's. And with increasing confidence and experience that we could do this, I think these criteria will get earlier and earlier, and as technology improves as well. So these are all the patients that consulted on our Duchenne's patients before we moved forward. Once the evaluation is complete, each case is presented to an ethics board consultation, a VAD heart failure selection committee that we have, and then the Heart Institute case management conference. So these are all three different venues, as well as there's actually a DMD interdisciplinary committee that also meets and evaluates these patients, obviously. Education is very important, discussing with the parents really what a VAD is and what they can expect. What the recovery would be, and to be very honest with them that, you know, this is not a known therapy. I can't tell them that the last 100 did this. They have to realize that this is a little bit of a journey and that we are exploring new territories and that we are learning a lot with each patient, and that that's very important for them to understand. And then we give them a lot of information. Again, this I don't see this as an emergent thing. This is something that, you know, you think about as a patient starts to decline to then start thinking about whether this can really extend their quality or their life. So our first was a 29-year-old man diagnosed at 7 years. He was wheelchair-bound by 11. He was a 9/11 dispatcher. He was on a sit vent and CPAP at night. He had been on Milrinone for 5 years with decreasing heart function. He was our first patient. We did a HeartMate 2 LVAD. Was extubated in 16 hours. Post-op D3, though, we were concerned about his device, and actually we had to do a device exchange, and we learned a lot about this patient and Duchenne's, and I'll talk about that. Required wound care and drainage of his pocket where the device was. For quite some time, it was never infected and was discharged home 2 months later, and now is 9 months, post-implant and doing well. This is him. Lessons learned. So it's very important when you – so we have obviously a cardiac ICU for our patients. Well, cardiac ICUs don't need Duchenne's patients. And so it's very important to orient your staff and everybody about Duchenne's patients and really partner with the part of the hospital who takes care of Duchenne's patients so your environment is a good place for these family and friends. We ask the family to write a summary of the patient's life, what their expectations are from this device, and why really they want the device. And so I think this is very important for them to, so it's clear that they have the same, what they're thinking is something that perhaps we can provide. You know, I don't know this is going to reverse, obviously it's not going to reverse Duchenne's, it's not going to reverse these things. What we do hope is that the lives that they're living now can be extended. We're also hoping that we may find that there's some secondary gain that we're not aware of. To know what is your muscle, you know, what are your symptoms and your weaknesses because of your muscle and your respiratory issues because of your muscle weakness and what is from heart failure, nobody knows that. And so this device may allow us to decipher those things. Questions about extubation, trying to get them extubated early and having, you know, respiratory therapists, and we have fortunate to have a few pulmonologists who just specialize in this, and it's really important for them to be part of that team. things that we learned, you know, they need larger rooms than most kids, right? Because they need for all the different equipment and getting specific respiratory equipment. Not all sit vents are the same. And if you've been on a sit vent, as you guys know, these patients know even the difference between different types of sit vent. And so we got a sit vent, but it actually wasn't something that he was comfortable with, and understanding that preoperatively. And so even though we thought we had taken this extensive history, we knew exactly what he wanted, we actually didn't know. And testing all of that out before going forward with the operation will be important. In terms of placing the device, so this is what I was talking about. So our first patient was late in his disease, and his amount of fascia and muscle was extremely thin. So his ability to heal a pocket was very delayed. And most, a lot of his recovery is because we were waiting for this pocket to heal. So perhaps for him, that device, the HeartMate 2, was not the best. And, you know, now our next patient, we use the HeartWare, which, remember, is a device that doesn't need a pocket. So that's one thing. Also, their diaphragms, as you all know, start to rise. And when you're placing a device with a pocket, you place it over the diaphragm. So if the heart is down here and the diaphragm's up here, hard to get there. And so understanding those things and using the CAT scans and planning ahead of time exactly how that device is going to lay in this particular patient will be very important. And that some patients, you know, so we had the HeartMate, then we got the HeartWare for our next patient, and we're fortunate enough that we were able even to get the Jarvik. And the Jarvik is neat because for some body habituses, you probably don't want a line coming out from the abdomen, and this has a way to track that line up transcutaneously, and then it comes out actually behind the ear. And so you can place a battery there, and that's how you connect to your battery. So you have actually nothing here, and that helps, especially with patients who have to be transferred a lot and be picked up from the middle section. So these are all things. And you guys know this, family support is critical. And most importantly, you know, our first patient actually had been on with a PICC line for 5 years and never had an infection and had never had a bed sore. So obviously that family had, I don't think any hospital could do that, by the way, right? That could never happen in a hospital. So that family had somehow figured out a way to take care of that child. And I think it's very important when these children come in especially that the nursing and the physicians understand that and understand that even that the methods that they're using may not be something that we think works. It's probably what works because, you know, proof's in the pudding. The kid never had an infection. And so really being more open to listening to them as we take care of these patients will be important. We talked about ICDs and then just discharge. You know, it's very different, especially if they can't use their upper extremities. They can't change their batteries. They can't do certain things with their VAD. So you have to consider that. And again, you know, it's very important to understand that this will not reverse Duchenne's, obviously. It may improve some symptoms. We don't know. We hope that's secondary gain, but this is really to change their natural history. This is a 23-year-old, actually, with Duchenne's, who's a female, who was our second patient. She had the HeartWare placed, and she did extremely well, and now is back in Oregon. And this is her. So she was basically saying that she was studying to be a teacher and she had to stop that because of her heart failure over a six-month period. And she fortunately was able to get the device. And she's remarkable because the number of letters she had to write to everybody in Oregon in order to be transferred and to get her care paid for in Cincinnati was unbelievable. But she did do that and she came there. And now she's back in Oregon and she just sent us her acceptance letter to a teaching college in Oregon. So our next is a 26-year-old boy who's actually in our hospital now, and we're evaluating him to see if he'll be a candidate. And we have two other young men who are coming. And again, as you see, we're trying to be very thoughtful on how we're going about this and you know, not trying to have too many patients come all at once so that we have a good understanding of what we can and can't do with this therapy. You know, one of our things is always to be safe. So unless we can do it safely and know that it's going to or be in the best environment to know it's going to work, we really don't want to rush into things. So, and there are many obstacles. Many of these patients are coming from out of state and insurance coverage, and then again finding that institution. I think that's something that we learned back at their hometown that they can go to is very important. So in summary, we thank JW, who is our first patient, for being a pioneer. We learned a lot after that implantation. I think the first two patients have shown us that we can do this safely, that this is going to be a therapy that we can use. And as technology improves, we'll probably be able to apply it more and to even younger patients. And as we implant earlier, we hope to see more secondary benefits in regards to activity and need for respiratory support. I feel that the potential to change the natural history of many boys and men with DMD who are living full lives is possible with devices and as technology improves. And our ability to do this will continue to improve with advancements in technology, experience, and DMD patients brave enough to perhaps change their own natural history. Thank you.